Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, part of the Once Upon a Podcast Network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And as an author, one of the things that I really am impressed by is the various means that everyone takes to make sure that their work is seen and experienced on as many different platforms as possible. Speaking as from my own experience, having written the book Excelsior, as well as its sequel and part three, which is in development, both books have audiobooks that were recorded, so that way I can get that audience. For those who are ebook readers, when the books come out again through my new publisher, then they'll be available there. But there's also the audio drama that's based on the first book that you can access on one of the shows on this network, Audio Drama Sunday Theater. And there are a lot of different ways that authors can get their works out to as many different platforms as possible. And I'm really excited to have my guest for this week, Dr. Leanna Wolf, to talk about this very thing herself. She had come up with an idea for her book 15 years ago, and only a couple of months ago, it got published along with the premiere of a companion solo show that's now presenting at the Hollywood Fringe Festival. This is a really interesting hour-long solo show. She plays different characters. She talks in different accents. She provides various forms of multimedia. There is so much that I am excited about to hear her story, how she came up with this, and everything that she is doing right now to use this as a means of really kind of getting her name out there as an author. I am really excited to have as my guest this week, Dr. Leanna Wolf. Leanna, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you so much for doing this. So tell us a little bit about this show in general. I'm really excited when you talked about what it is that you're doing, the different forms of media. Mm-hmm. It really sounds like you have something really special here.
Yeah. Well, basically, the concept was a memoir, which came out of an assignment I gave my anthropology students. And I was teaching courses like the anthropology of sex or gender, sex, and culture and such at university level. And one of their optional assignments was to write a sex history. And I thought, you know, I've never really looked at my own sex history. So I began to do that. And as I started doing it, I realized that I had done so many things as a sex researcher that I never intended to do anything more than understand it as much as I could as a social scientist. And it wasn't like every time I dated or had sex with someone, I had any intention of having that progress towards a relationship or marriage or all the rest of it. I was just trying to find out all the things that humans could do and what they had done in different parts of the world. Because as an anthropologist, I did field work in a number of different places. So that became the basis of what I was writing, was my life as a sex researcher. And the first title of the book is 177 Lovers and Counting. And I never intended to throw that number around. But what happened is I was in a writing group with, this was right after I attempted to retire from teaching, and I was used to a really busy schedule. And so I joined a daytime writing group to try to fill up my time. And it turned out the folks in this group were a generation older than me and had grown up in different ways than I had. I had come of age in the thick of the sexual revolution and second wave feminism in Berkeley in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. And they would just roll their eyes when they'd hear about the things I'd done.
And really?
So one day I thought, well, I have to kind of make sense to them. So I titled one of the essays, 177 Lovers and Counting. Wow. And soon the leader of the group told me I was being too provocative and that it would be best that I leave the group. And find a group that was more appropriate. So I did, and I have, and I basically found the world of solo theater to be a really welcoming world. I have, been to some solo shows over the years, but I hadn't particularly paid attention to it as something that I might do. And so I took a bunch of workshops and learned about characters and worked with a director, and she helped me take sections of my book and theatricalize them and, create dialogue and create things that were a little more visual and fun. And then I started bringing in videos and bringing in images, things that I had shot from traveling in other places. And at the same time, basically retaining the privacy of the various guys that I was mentioning. Mm-hmm. So I, didn't have pictures of them. And right. I gave them pseudonyms. So it could remain my story through my lens. And that is what happened. And we premiered the show last month in mid-January in Solo Fest at the Whitefire Theater here in Los Angeles. And I sold out. I mean, it was just amazing. Basically, folks came because it was also the launch of my book. Mm-hmm. And then people kept talking about how much fun it was and how entertaining it was and that they wanted to see it again and people who hadn't seen it want to see it. So I ended up deciding to do the Hollywood Fringe Festival this June and lined up a theater. And this time I booked 3 performances. So hopefully all the Southern Californians will get to see it. And I've also being an academic, I still go to conferences. And so I have several conferences lined up, and I did a couple of conferences last month. And so they put me on the program sometimes as the keynote doing the whole show and other times as a presenter doing a portion of the show. And many of the conference attendees are like, wow, so you're not just doing a standard PowerPoint and reading your slides, but you're dancing around the stage and you're talking in different accents and you're talking about how you figured out orgasm by moaning and groaning across the stage. And it's been really fun.
Sure. It sounds like a blast. And I love the fact that it incorporates so much different types of media as well to really get people's attention. So is the name of the show the same as the name of the memoir?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And we don't call it a memoir anymore. The publisher decided to call it an autoethnography, which is basically a memoir through the lens of anthropology. So anthropologists write ethnographies, which are descriptions of culture. Right. And mine is a description of me as a subject of the culture I engaged through the years. And of course, there were many. And then to make it a proper textbook, we put in all kinds of added contextual information. Excellent. So, for example, I started having sex in 1973. That was the year that Roe versus Wade became the law of the land. So that invited a whole discussion of abortion and how humans had managed and explained and justified abortion throughout the centuries. So talking about medieval Europe and what was and what were the explanations then, and how unique it is that these days the rights of the unborn are seen as important, where before the issues had to do with inheritance, where if a wealthy man had encounter with a young woman who was not his wife, the last thing he wanted was for that potential child to inherit his wealth. So the most expedient thing to do was to have an abortion. So it is all about inheritance. No one cared at all about the rights of the unborn. And, you know, and then, you know, through the women's movement, we started caring about the rights of women, and that a woman had a right to choose what she did with her body, and that she had the right to decide if she didn't want to carry a baby that, or a fetus or an embryo that implanted in her. And so this became a huge and fascinating discussion, which I weave into those sections of the book.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
And then I did a ton of sex research myself, a fair amount of it funded by other sources. And so I spend a fair amount of the book discussing some of the findings of my research and the journey of handling information that I made sense of, and how to how I brought it into the media and whatever else I did with my research.
Wow. And the experience of writing this book, it sounds fascinating. So it definitely sounds like something that you had been wanting to pursue for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it'd been something that had been part of how I taught my classes, is I would talk about research I had done, but I never really talked that much about the backstory of the research. And I think anyone who's a student of social sciences wants to understand, well, how do you make sense of your observations? And how do you take those observations and make them scientific? And what pieces of those findings can you then generate or propose some type of theory around? And so that's a bit of what goes on in my book. So, for example, in the early 90s, which was kind of around the time polyamory was getting named in Western society, and you know, there had always been, you know, multiple partner relationships, some of them quite unspoken and others, you know, in the forms of traditional polygamy. The partner I had got involved with another woman, and he, you know, typically in Western society, if that happens, you go to marriage counseling or couples counseling or something and try to put an end to it. Either say, you know, leave the relationship or stop the affair or somehow resolve it in a way that it does not continue. Right. And being an anthropologist, I thought, well, let me find out what goes on in more traditional societies. So I left for Africa and I landed in Nairobi. I met with a professor at the University of Nairobi who studies traditional polygamy and discussed how it was handled in villages there. And then I proceeded to go to villages and observe and engage and question myself. And basically, I was presenting myself to the Africans I was meeting as someone who was had a dilemma that was familiar to theirs, because there were any number of first wives who at some point in their marriage, their husband brought in a second wife. And I would say, well, how did you handle it? And so they would tell me all kinds of fascinating things. Well, you know, growing up in a context where a husband having multiple wives was not unusual, you know, I felt I had to adjust. Some of them refused to adjust and just said they would rather leave the marriage than stay. But some of them assessed that they needed the money and identity of being a wife and having resources from their husband and having their husband be connected to their children. And that was preferable to just leaving. Right. And so, and then they'd look at me and they'd say, hey, you're a Western woman. You have an education. You have a way to make a living as a professor. You should leave. Why are you staying? And so this all became pretty fascinating to me to have them like challenge me on why I was trying to stay when they thought I had the means to leave. And this was 1998, happened to be around the time that Bill Clinton was having the affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
And they said, you know, she should stay and give the president another child. He only has one daughter. She looks young and fertile. Her Hillary looks like she probably couldn't have any more children. A man of this wealth and prestige should have a larger family. And they didn't, to them, it made no sense that he would distance himself from Monica, claimed that it wasn't a significant love interest and he had no reason to keep her on in his life. And so it was really, you know, it taught me so much through their stories and questions and examples about their worldview versus the world that I had been living in the West.
Right.
And so these were the ways that I was able to generate some really interesting stories and theories and such.
Wow. And not only is that fascinating regarding the behind the scenes stuff and the making and the reasoning behind the development of this book, but there's also the way that you also broke it down. It sounds very much like if anyone were curious to follow in your direction and put together a book similar, maybe not the same topic, but at least like something that is meaningful to them, but they can also utilize these elements that you bring in. It sounds like all they have to do is kind of like follow along with your book and see like, well, okay, so this was done like this. And then if I go ahead and add this and this and this, it sounds very, you know, very well structured. In a way that a lot of people can follow.
It's a tricky thing because each of us has our own personalities and our own ways of engaging others and generating theory out of experience and opportunity. You know, for example, I had many years later in 2018, I had an opportunity to go to Niger, which is one of the poorest countries of West Africa, where they have some tribal festivals like the Garawal Festival, which is known as a marriage market, where eligible young men perform not just for young women, but for the whole community to attract a wife and ultimately to start a family because they're nomadic people. Yeah. And so I went there, and the more I watched them dance and saw the very specific prescriptions for their dance, I started seeing a whole other piece of story here, because basically they were told what kind of makeup to put on, what kind of costume to wear, what kind of dance steps to do. And as, and these were things that the community or tribe had done for many generations. And as long as they did this, they were then celebrated by the elders, by their families, by their peers, and by the young women. And ultimately, what was going on is young male adolescent sexuality and fertility was being embraced. And when I thought about the Western world and how absolutely difficult we make it for young men who have lots of sexual drive and energy and curiosity,
but no direction.
You know, like, and there's no direction.
Yeah, like, it just goes all over the place. You know?
Yeah, and they basically become embarrassed and shunned, and they're told to go into sports, or maybe they find their way to the backseat of a car, or you know what, or they or they stumble in one way or another and are not treated as gorgeous, virile men. And so that was like my takeaway from the Garawal Festival, was how an basically enlightened community celebrated its young men.
And it's almost like a language in motion based on that. When you said that there are certain moves that have to be done to really properly convey the message.
Right.
It sounds like its own language.
Yeah, and it was. And they, and you could see how, you know, the young men who did it absolutely perfect, who had the right dance moves, who had their makeup on perfect, were the ones that were singled out as being like the winners. And then they had a couple of young women decide which one they really wanted. But then after the performance, there was additional dancing, and all the rest of the young women there had an opportunity to make offers to these gorgeous men.
Wow. Wow. That sounds fascinating. That's a really interesting way to convey that. It's so different from what we're used to in our own culture.
I know. And we somehow think that this is a good thing, is to not educate our young people about how their bodies work, and to shun them for having sexual energy and for being, and giving them no means in which to celebrate how beautiful they are.
Yeah. And not only that, but by consistently shunning them, by consistently pushing that aside, hiding it, and forcing them to just kind of figure things out on their own, that's a big reason why we're getting as much violence.
Yes.
As well in this, because
there's so much frustration.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's the frustration. Exactly what you said. It's very built up. They have no means of how to get it out properly. And a lot of people, they either want to figure it out, others don't want to figure it out and just want to act out in rage. And it can be very scary when it's just unchecked like that.
Yes.
So getting back to your own book, your own experiences, it took a while to get the book itself done, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I had some beginnings, and then some of the chapters were very confusing to me, how to write them, one of the chapters that I had struggled with, but ultimately, I became really happy with how it played out, was this chapter that I did on cheating. And what had happened is, soon after I did my doctorate in sexology, where I did a dissertation on polyamory and jealousy, someone hired me to do a study on cheating. And And I, you know, initially it was tricky to get people to respond to our survey because people who practice polyamory want to be studied. Many of them are academically oriented and they want the word out about how their practices work and they want to be respected for it. People who cheat, even though that's so much more common than practicing consensual non-monogamy, don't want to be known. And so it had to be anonymous. And largely we were attracting folks who had been cheated on and wanted to talk about how all the things that they considered to be cheating. And so we had, as to be expected, a lot more women than men participating. And then the guys who owned the Ashley Madison website contacted me and said, hey, you seem to be a pretty cool sex researcher. Would you like to partner with us and do some more research on cheating? And I agreed to. And then we had all kinds of research dilemmas. And so in the book, I talk about, like, you know, what, how they approached me and what I claimed we could do, because I had this feeling I'd get a lot of data. And it turned out I did. Like, in a couple of weeks of the survey that we agreed on being on their site, I got 7,000 respondents, which was huge relative to what I was typically getting. But the thing is their research question, which I kind of thought was a little wonky, was that they thought that folks were they wanted to investigate whether folks were cheating to get more anal sex. And anal sex is, you know, something that folks in the kink world and might find kind of interesting. And the typical person who was on a heterosexual person who was on a cheating website might check it off, but it really wasn't a big deal. And it wasn't the kind of thing that they would leave their home relationship for. And fortunately I had agreed to also, I wove in other questions, and the questions that actually got some interesting data attached to them had to do with oral sex. And what I was seeing was that the men, by and large, believed that other men were having more oral sex in their home relationships than they were.
Interesting.
For the women, either way, you know, no particular report on it that stood out.
Right.
And then the more, and then we started asking them, well, you know, if you wanted oral sex, where would you go? And the men were, who were, these subjects were basically guys in their 40s and 50s who were in otherwise monogamous marriages in terms of, you know, living with one other person.
Right.
They said that they would want it from a secret lover. They wouldn't want it from a prostitute. And I started thinking about this and I was saying, well, what's going on? And I thought, well, you know, for a man to receive oral sex, it's something where they're getting to look at the person who's giving it to them. Their eyes are not closed. They're looking at her, engaging him in a very intimate way and affirming him in an intimate way. And that's part of what makes it so exquisite is this is a woman who's really into him, who's wanting to do this to him, which is very different than women. Because women basically think of oral sex, especially if they're heterosexual, as foreplay. And oftentimes their eyes are closed.
Yeah, just something to get through in order to...
Not necessarily receiving
there,
it.
There are a lot of them that, you know, that do enjoy it. You know, like
It's some, like a foreplay. It prepares her for intercourse.
Yeah.
And so their experience of it is very different. in terms of how essential it is.
Yeah.
It's, and so that became the analysis I had was, and then the folks at Ashley Madison didn't like my analysis and tried to skew my data because they wanted to make it look like, because the, a lot of the women on their site were actively cheating. You probably have heard about all the stuff with their bots, but these were active women on the site, and they, their motivation for looking for an affair was to stay in their marriage and to get attention from someone who they enjoyed being attended from.
Right.
And so they were not doing it for oral sex. They were doing it from, for attention. And it was the men who might have that as a specific goal. And so they didn't like that I was showing them that the women, that was not a primary motivation. And so they didn't want to promote the study findings because they wanted something sensational like women cheat for oral sex, which
which, yeah, which definitely would be something that they think would attract more people to their site, while you know, while the actual, while the actual data shows shows a different behavioral pattern.
Right. So I stuck to being a scientist and refused to participate any further with them in promoting something that wasn't
That's not true. Exactly. You got to have your, if you continued on with that, then you would have felt that you were sacrificing your dignity and integrity.
Absolutely.
And that's, you worked too hard for that. So
exactly. Money wasn't worth it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, so one thing that, that really has me curious is, what was it that spawned the idea of getting that, the live show done in the first place? Cause we were talking a little bit about the development of the book before we started recording, and you, the way you mentioned it, I thought was fascinating because it's something similar that I'm dealing with right now with on a completely different topic. It's my own, YA sci-fi book. So, but it's, I've been stuck on part three for the longest time. And a lot of it is procrastination. A lot of it is, you know, really trying to crack this story more than anything. But I had an opportunity to turn the first book into an audio drama. So I just pivoted off of that and started working on that. And it actually helped somewhat. It kind of, you know, shook the rust out a little bit. But I'm curious to see, like, what was it that really got things going for the live show?
Oh, well, several things. One is that when I was a kid, I did a lot of live theater. I was in the I was in children's theater and often was cast in leading roles. But ultimately, I decided to become an anthropologist and not an actor. But teaching was kind of like my one woman show for years and years, like several nights a week, I gave lectures and pranced around the classroom and got people to laugh and got them to engage my ideas and all that. So I was pretty comfortable being in front of an audience. And then I, for a while, I got interested in like performance storytelling. And so I was doing some of that. And then I heard about solo theater and that there were workshops going on here in Los Angeles. So I started taking them. And then at some point I was like so procrastinated on getting my book done that I just thought, you know, I just need to finish this because I'm basically someone who finishes the thing she starts. And I'll just do it as a solo show. And so for a while, I was trying to organize it as a solo show. And then the pandemic hit. And it was like, do I really want to do this show to an empty theater that's live streamed just to be finished with it. And it sounded boring.
Yeah, there's no energy there.
The live audience of teaching.
Yeah.
So I just said, well, maybe since I've watched every series on Netflix, it's time to work on my book. Mm. And so in the quiet of the pandemic, I managed to plow through all those chapters that seemed insurmountable and just get them done. Oh, one excellent. Of the things I did just to get myself, because I'm so attention oriented, mm-hmm. was I would publish the chapters as I finished them as essays on Medium. And, you know, anybody can publish on Medium. It's really simple.
Yeah.
And then I'd get the link and put it on some other social media and get a little bit of attention. And it just helped keep me going, because it's so hard to do things in a vacuum if you're a bit of an extrovert. And
right.
And so eventually the book got as done as it could be. And I began looking for publisher. And I was really fortunate that through my network of researchers and writers, I found Roman and Littlefield, and some of the folks I knew were looking for books just like mine. And so my book got adopted.
Yeah.
And then as we were getting ready for publication, I thought, you know, it would be really fun to do the solo theater as well.
That's great.
I reached out to some of the solo theater folks, and the timing was perfect to apply to be part of Solo Fest, which is the largest solo theater festival in the country. And it's here in Los Angeles at the Whitefire Theater. And they accepted my show.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So
that's great.
And it was fun. Yeah. And it was also a really great way to share it with other audiences, too. So for the first thing that happened is an anthropology conference was informed about it, and they agreed to put me on as their keynote speaker. So they got a performance as their keynote.
Along That's terrific.
with all kinds of moving images and orgasms and different voices, and they enjoyed it tremendously.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I continued on and got other conferences to agree to it. So it's been a really fun journey. And one of the things I noted was we sold out for my show at the Whitefire Theater.
Yes.
Sold all 85 seats, and then they added extra chairs for all the other folks who wanted to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the show, I had books for sale, but I sold only about 10 books. And
really?
I thought, oh my God. So some people felt really complete with just seeing the show.
Right.
And they didn't need to buy a book.
Mm.
And so I realized the theater piece just has a life of its own.
Yeah.
And I do not expect everybody to buy the book. Not that many people read anymore, but a lot of people enjoy entertainment. And
that's for sure.
So I accept that lots of people are going to want to come to my show. And as it gets better and better, I'll get to take it to other theaters and other places. And it doesn't matter if not everyone buys the book.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you have like this whole other bit of income, really, you know, kind of coming in for that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I'm so glad that you were able to kind of pivot with that. So that's something that a lot of authors really need to remember. They don't have to confine themselves to just the book. Or, you know, just the book and the ebook and audiobook or whatever. They can take it in as many different directions as they can. It's their book. Why not have fun with it?
Yeah, I do want to do an audiobook, I've been a little bit at a conundrum of which direction to go, because, it's possible to do your audiobook with AI and have it be very easy. You just get enough voice sample going and throw up a PDF and have AI create it. But if I want to do different voices, like as you were talking, like a radio drama kind of thing, then I really need to record it myself with all my different voices.
And not only that, but you know, with this, I mean, like the subject matter, it's all about passion. And AI has none of the passion. So it would basically be just like reading it from the perspective of a cold fish. So I strongly, strongly recommend, as someone who read his own audiobooks, I strongly recommend taking that plunge, especially considering how personal the material is. I feel that only you can really put the proper kind of spin on it.
Thank you. That really helps.
Yeah. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, but not particularly active. I have a website. It's called wisewomansexandrelationshipconsulting.com. And my book is all over the internet.
Excellent.
It's called Devon Lovers and Counting, My Life as a Sex Researcher.
Fabulous. Fabulous. And I hope that even if the topic itself may not be something that you're drawn to, just the way that Leanna properly breaks down this her story in a very interesting manner, I believe that will definitely get the proper attention. And I really hope that everyone who has thought about wanting to get their books out in as many different formats as possible, here's another success story. It's all right here. You don't have to just rely on the book. You can take it in as many different directions as you want. Just don't expect to do a complete copy and paste into this other format. You have to let that other format dictate what it is that you're doing. And if you do that, if you're able to pivot the way that you need to, then there's nothing you can't do in this field. So for Dr. Leanna Wolf, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to he'sgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to george@he'sgotit.com.